Hi, today is April 11th, 2021. This is Movieviews Podcast 358. Todd Gossewart, my good friend John Westfall. A couple of small things, and John's got one big thing to talk about. So, how you doing, John?
I'm doing very good. It's starting to be more spring-like, summer-like where I am, and it's always like that where you're at, but I'm enjoying the weather and the fact that, you know, it's something different than the long winter of isolation. So.
Well, as in a trivia note, so we are in the 70s right now. What is it in my house? I think it says 73. 73. I've got all the windows open and stuff, of course. We hardly ever close our windows. But here in Hawaii, that's considered cold. And so people are whining about it being chilly. Anyway, yeah, bunch of whiners. Weather whiners. Anyway, the first thing I wanted to mention was something I read in something called Amplifamedia. Never heard of them, but they had some interesting data. And what they're saying is that, you know, 26% of published podcasts have only one episode, and then the person or people quit. So you and I, John, with 358 total podcasts, and I think you've been on like almost 300 of them, we are amongst kind of an elite, because only 36% have of podcasters have produced 10 or more podcast episodes. And of course, we've got like hundreds now. You know, the vast majority are fewer than 10 episodes. In fact, 44% are 3 or fewer episodes, and 37% are 2 or fewer episodes. So, you know, we are amongst the top third. We're not 1%ers, but we're in the 36%ers, which is not a bad place to be.
And I defy people to find a podcast that is not, that has our level of amount of content, but also our audio listenership level. Our fives of listeners that are very devoted. I assume that's a very strange ratio of, number of listens plus number of episodes, or, episodes to listen.
Well, at any rate, so I thought it was an interesting statistic. Or observation, whatever you want to call it. I don't know exactly how. I think it's based on the Apple podcast data, by the way. Yeah, Apple podcast data. So it's only Apple podcast data. It doesn't include other, distribution venues like Libsyn, really popular podcasting service, which I don't use. I probably should have, but I'm okay with the one I've got for the last 12 years, whatever it's been now. And Google Podcast. And, the interesting thing is, and I guess I should differentiate between the storage service like Libsyn, and I use Podbean, if anybody's curious, and Google Podcasts and Apple Podcasts, is neither Google nor Apple actually provide storage. So we, as the podcaster, provide the storage / distribution point, origination point. Libsyn or Podbean or whatever, and then they provide the distribution. So, if you think we're storing this somewhere on Google or Apple, the answer is no, I have to pay for that. It's not much. It's not a big deal. It's a lot less than most hobbies people have. I don't know what a carton of cigarettes costs these days, but it's probably less than a couple of cartons a year.
Might be just as harmful to your health. Don't know.
Well, it doesn't harm your lungs, at least.
Yeah.
But at any rate, okay, this is something that caught me by surprise. So John probably hasn't seen this because he's not an Android user, but I have both an Android phone and an iPhone, and I actually use my Android phone for a bunch of stuff. And one of the things I do almost every day is I check for updates for the apps. Actually, I probably check more often than the iPhone for some reason, because the apps get more frequently updated for some reason, or more times per week I seem to see an update for my Android than my iPhone. But in any case, a couple of days ago, I went to the usual place, the hamburger menu, to update it, and it wasn't there. And it said, go to your profiles, and it's in there now. And then a couple of days later, the hamburger menu disappeared. In fact, let me go check on my Pixel 4a. So go to Play Store. Yeah, it doesn't have a hamburger menu at all now. So they kind of eased me into it. First, you know, I have hamburger menu. No, we're not here anymore. Go get used to tapping your profile, and then now it's in there. Now, the interesting thing about it is, you know, the hamburger menu has been around. For those who don't know what I'm referring to, it's the three lines that you see as a place to click on options, normally on phones, but also on other devices these days. It has been used for options for years now. In fact, it took a while for people to get used to looking for the hamburger menu, and now we're trained to do it, and that's where I go. But Google, in their infinite wisdom, has decided that it is not a good thing for at least their Play Store. And so they've completely gotten rid of it. And now for various settings, you actually tap your profile, which, you know, used to be like where your account information and things like that were in. But now it's got apps and games and library and Play Protect and settings. And, you know, basically everything that used to be in hamburger menus there plus. And the interesting thing is I noticed just last year, I think, that Microsoft Teams, which, you know, didn't have a lot of stuff, but as it was getting more stuff, and now it's like a full-featured platform, its settings are also in profile. So there seems to be some kind of UI UX shift away from hamburger menus or a hamburger button or whatever you want to call it, and pull-down menus and all of that, to sticking everything in a profile. So I don't know if you've run across it, John, but those are the two big ones that I noticed over the last week at least.
Yeah, I have not noticed that yet, but it's an interesting shift. The hamburger menu or, you know, the ellipsis menu, if it looks like that, or the junk drawer menu in a sense, whatever else we can't find a spot for, we throw it in there. It seemed to be working just fine. And so I'm kind of curious what the rationale is behind removing it, other than perhaps developers were using it so much like a virtual junk drawer that it just wasn't as easy to navigate anymore. And I have seen some of them get much more cluttered than you would expect. But yeah, it's a weird shift, because I agree. I'm very used to, you go there and that's where you find this sort of content and these options, and strange to see it missing.
Right. Before I continue on, I wanted to mention that, I've been experimenting with microphones with John, unfortunately. And so I've tried my AirPods Pro as a microphone, and of course the Blue Yeti that I normally use. I've used for number of years now. And what else did I try? I tried a couple of Bluetooth headsets, and none of the audio quality for it quite fit. Today I was going to try the lavalier mic lavalier mic that I was using for conference calls for a number of months during the pandemic. But John said there was a buzz when I used it, so I am back to the Blue Yeti. Is that what it's called? Yeah, I think it's called the Blue Yeti, which quite frankly has the best sound, but it's kind of gigantic, and I don't have a nice studio setup with a boom and all of that, so it's, you know, sort of in the way. So I thought I'd try to get away from it. Anyway, back to the Blue Yeti, using my AirPods Pro as my headset. Normally use a pair of plug-in headsets, like a $12 plug-in headset, you know, with a jack, but this is working out well, I think.
And now the question is, how long have you had that buzz that you've annoyed all of your friends with?
You know, I wonder about that now. I wonder about that. I will say that I have never used it with a Mac before. I've been using it with Windows, so I don't know if there's some kind of difference. Maybe the mini jack on my MacBook Pro is, you know, got some, I don't know, something wrong with it, you know, that's allowing that buzz to be created.
It's very hard to figure out some of those things, where you're just going, how is it that this buzz happens or that happens? And it does seem to be sometimes dependent on the application that's recording it or producing it. So,
yeah, the codec or whatever.
I guess you'll have to play around with it. But it was a small buzz. It was one of those ones that it wasn't terribly annoying, but it was there.
It was noticeable. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and it's really interesting because I have bought, I don't know, how many headsets and microphones during the pandemic. And, you know, I test them, right? I don't just, you know, foist them on people unsuspectingly. I test them with like an audio recording app and to see what the volume levels look like compared to whatever mic I'm using. And they all sounded okay to me. But then when I use them in Teams especially, which is what I use mostly for talking these days, although John and I use Skype for historical reasons, you know, or hysterical reasons, one or the other. When I use Teams, anyway, they tell me, "Oh, your volume is really low, and you know, did you change your mic or whatever?" And I go, "Gee, I don't know what's going on here. Sounds fine in the audio recorder, but yeah, it is mysterious. And I wish there were a better way for us to test audio. Skype does have a nice audio test. I do use Microsoft Teams has an audio test. You know, you can use to check your microphone levels, but it doesn't seem to matter." And of course, this is hidden in profiles also, by the way. So if you go into Microsoft Teams, you go into profiles to check if, you know, to check and or set and check your audio and video devices. But anyhow, now the other thing I wanted to mention was from Pew Research, for, you know, a lot of people have probably heard of, they have a really interesting a publication, a report, I guess I should say, that talks about social media use during the pandemic. And the thing I found most interesting is, you know, there's some age group difference and all of that. But what I was expecting to see, you know, kind of my non-data driven theory, was it all social media, Twitter, Facebook, LinkededIn, you know, whatever, went up during the pandemic because people would want to stay in touch, and that's how you stay in touch. But I was wrong. According to Pew Research, it says, with exception of YouTube and Reddit, most platforms showed little growth since 2019. And I was really surprised by that. I don't know about you, John.
Yeah, but when you think about what people were discovering, Reddit and YouTube might have been those places that people got sucked into a ton of content that they hadn't really thought about before existing.
Yeah.
You know, Facebook and Twitter, we probably had our people that we followed on there, and those platforms are not really made for discoverability in the same way that Reddit and Twitter are.
Good point.
Reddit and YouTube are.
Good point.
So if you build a platform that the whole design is try to get people to start viewing more and more and keep them there as long as possible, I suspect that is where we see the difference.
Yeah. Yeah, good point, John. Very good point. Yeah, and, you know, I don't know about you, John, but I definitely go. I don't use Reddit much anymore. I used to read it a lot before. And I guess Dig prior to that. But I certainly go down a variety of rabbit holes when I am on YouTube. I mean, I'll start at one thing. I'll start, like, looking at the news. And then, you know, the next thing I'm looking at a dog playing in the snow or something like that. So,
Yes. Yeah, it's very easy on YouTube. And then very easy to find content creators that you think of as, wow, that's a cool idea to put a whole show behind that, and someone has done it. So,
yeah, and you know, I should note, it's not in our show notes, but you know, as our five listeners know, I blame John for a whole bunch of things, and one of the things I blame him for is that I recently bought I recently bought a DJI Osmo 3 for my iPhone, which is, you know, kind of, it's called a gimbal or Steadicam is what some people. So actually, Steadicam is a registered trademark, so it's a Steadicam-like device to stabilize your video when you're taking videos on the move. Anyway, I bought one of these things thinking, oh, it must be easy to use. You know, you don't need a PhD like John to use it. But it turns out
it helps. That's the problem. It helps to have that PhD because, yeah, there could be a lot of options there.
But, and so I get this thing, and the first thing is like, how do I pull the arm out? But at any rate, I had to actually watch a video to figure out how to put it back in the case that I bought for it. So I used YouTube a lot to learn about the Osmo 3.
They don't tell you that, you know, some of the things that you think of are going to be very easy. They're not as easy as they sound.
No, but so I had to do a lot more learning than I expected to do. I thought I would just, you know, mount the phone and start shooting and I'd be, you know, fat, dumb, and happy. Well, I'm fat and dumb, but I was not exactly happy after I learned that, oh, I need to learn stuff. But fortunately, there are some pretty good tutorials out there on how to use it. So I go through all the options and what and so forth. So I've been pretty happy with that. I still got a lot to learn, but those YouTube videos were really very, very useful. I should probably give credit to some of those folks. I've saved some of those, and I'll put them in the show notes. So that, you know, a little way of giving credit. Okay, the last thing I wanted to mention before we get into John's big topic, which I'm very curious about because I know nothing about it, relatively speaking. Or at least, you know, I knew John was doing something. I didn't know what.
That gets people in trouble. They know I'm up to something, but they don't know what it is.
Anyhow, the last item I have in my show notes is Google has a kind of fun, or interesting at least, maybe fun might not be the operative word, is, but during the pandemic, you know, what did people really look for in terms of pastimes? You know, what to do during the pandemic, aside from survive and hopefully, you know, have enough income to do so. But I have a link to what they call Take a Look at These Pandemic Pastimes, and Google has teamed up with a company I never heard of, but they're really interesting. They are called, this is an external company, oh shucks, what's it called? Pudding, The Pudding, with an entity called The Pudding. Worked at design studio Polygraph, who are the creators of The Pudding, to create an interactive tool to let you take a look at what people were doing during the ongoing pandemic in terms of, you know, how to keep themselves occupied. So really interesting stuff. I really encourage you to look. And having never heard of The Pudding, I went to The Pudding. And they have some really, really interesting data visualizations of topics that you might not, you might not think about, or you thought about, you didn't know if anybody's ever looked at it. My favorite one, by the way, is, and they have it divided by categories, I think it was under sports, yeah. So there's they have a sports section with dynamic data visualizations. And one of the discussions is the worst, highest paid NBA player ever. And they've got the data and rationalization to back that statement up, and I won't spoil their choice, although fans of the NBA will probably know who it is. But, boy, they've got some really fun stuff. The rise of hyphenated last names in pro sports. That's another data visualization you have. I think The Pudding is going to be one of my new favorite websites to go down rabbit holes. In the case, pastimes.
It's very easy to fall down those rabbit holes.
So anyway, this tool, you know, divides it up into like cooking and all kinds of pastimes, and they have graphs of you know, when things peaked. It's a ton of fun to take a look at. Again, Google with the folks that created The Pudding, and again, I'm scrolling through it too fast, called Polygraph, design studio named Polygraph. You'd think Google would have their own resources to do this, you know, without a partner. But it's nice that they found a really interesting partner. All right. Now, for the main thing, I'm really curious. I'm just going to try to stay quiet while John explains to me what he has been doing that I did not... That I knew he was doing something, but I didn't know what he was doing. So, what have you done lately, John, that was, you know, it's actually legal and stuff?
Last fall, I guess it was last September or so. In fact, I can actually look up when it was. I was on Facebook, and one of my colleagues at Delta State, where I teach, was talking about the fact that he ran his own virtual private server or his own web server.
Mm-hmm.
And this was, you know, other than myself, this is not something that I see happen very often with professors. Most of the time, we are of two minds with technology. Either we don't need anything special, we can barely use email, that is one unfortunate grouping, or we are so technically kind of down a rabbit hole, in a sense, that we don't, we're not really looking for anything new, we are just kind of stuck with what we're doing. And I actually have a friend who, you know, for a number of years ran a server from his office at his university. They eventually kicked him out of doing that because they didn't want to have a server that they weren't managing on
right.
campus and on-prem for obvious security options. Yeah, this was, so I saw this around mid-July last year. And so I thought, it got me thinking about how if you are a fairly, you know, tech-savvy person, you're not a sysadmin or a administrator, but you're tech-savvy, you know that there's more that you can do with a website or more that you could do than just have a web presence through a Medium blog or a Wix website or something like that. You know that there's options to install your, you know, certain software or open source software and all that, but you probably don't know exactly how to get into that.
Mm.
Because if you're not in system administration, you know, where do you even start getting into creating something in the cloud when you don't even know where the cloud is or how to, you know, find it or any of those things? So I pitched an idea to the book publisher that I've written this is now my fourth book through, A Press.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, how about a basics book that will be entitled Set Up and Manage Your Virtual Private Server? Basically making system administration accessible to people who are technically smart, they're willing to learn, but it's not their background. So people who have the time, the ambition, and want to be able to do it themselves, how do they even get started on that sort of thing?
Mm-hmm.
So the editors there, the acquisitions editors, thought it was a great idea, so they greenlit it, and it is now available on A-Press's website as well as Amazon. I can kind of walk through what it has in it.
Sure.
Because it's got some interesting things that I've picked up. And, of course, this is stuff that I've been picking up and playing with for over 20 years. So this is really my best known secrets or tips that I've picked up. So it starts off with kind of a chapter on very basic, what is a virtual private server? If you've ever had a friend ask you, you know, what are servers? And what does a server even do? Is it a computer? Is it on another computer? So I talk about, you know, a server, a bare bones server, and then, you know, virtualization, what virtualization means. I have a couple of analogies in there. So the first chapter basically assumes that you know, you've heard of the term server, but you have no idea what it is and what it does and how it's different from a regular computer. So once you know what it is, then I have a chapter on how you select a VPS provider, because there are a ton of different options out there. You can go with what are kind of referred to as low-end providers that just will give you a space, basically, and connect it up to the internet, and you figure everything else out. You do your own backups, you do your own administration. If their server, data center goes up in a puff of smoke, hopefully you had good backups somewhere else, because they're not going to help you. Then there are mid-level providers that are, you know, they might throw in some backup abilities. They might throw in a nice control panel. They might throw in a few other perks. And obviously, this is where you find things like Amazon Web Services and Oracle's Cloud and Microsoft's Azure and those sorts of things. Maybe you want to get into that to have those nice abilities. Of course, you'll pay more. And then there are other solutions that, you know, maybe you don't really need a virtual private server. You know, I do talk a little bit in there about what just a web host provider would give you, and will that be enough for you? Because I think that's it's a weird world. I mean, I pay a ridiculously small amount of money each year for my virtual private servers that I run. But that's because I'll do everything with them. And, you know, I have them ready to be rebuilt at a moment's notice, etc. But that's not going to be an option for most people.
That's really interesting. It's basically, it's a whole different publisher, but it's sort of philosophically similar to the Four Dummies series, where, you know, it's something you want to do, you need to do, you just don't quite know what all the pieces are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It very much is written sort of on that well, and I tapped into some analogies that I've used for, some of them are over 20 years old, to explain to people things like port numbers. And firewalls.
Yeah.
What are these things, you know, in everyday language so that you know if someone says, do you have your firewall set up? Well, what are you even talking about? You know, you don't think of firewall because it's got such a fun name. You don't think of it as just being a list of rules. You know, you think it must do something more than that. And it doesn't. It's just a list of rules. That's the first two chapters. Then we get into such a fun chapter, basic Linux administration via the command line. So if you've never used the command line interface anymore, or you know, this will get you kind of up and running with basic commands and how to log into your VPS and all those things. Then I have a chapter that probably people will be mad at me that I made this one chapter 4. But basic administration via a graphical user interface. So there's an open source product called Webmin that's been around for 30 years now.
It's awesome.
Talk about how you install it, how you configure it, you know, and there's a happy medium somewhere between those two chapters for most people. Some people can do it completely alone without a GUI. Some really want the GUI, and if it's properly installed and configured and secured, it's fine to use it. And we talk about, you know, how to put in SSL encryption so that you're connecting to these things over HTTPS or an encrypted channel. And, of course, SSH for your administration on the command line. So, you know, an eye toward keeping it secure, but also keeping it easy enough for someone to get started with. Then a whole chapter on the basics of Linux security. So tips on hardening your server and, you know, what to disable, best security practices, how to do auditing on, where to check your log files, how to see what people are trying to do, those sorts of things. Chapter on backups and version control. So a little bit of how do you make it so that if your server does go up in a puff of smoke, you've got backups somewhere where you can get them and restore them. A little bit on version control, not much, but you know, why you might want to use version control, how you can use version control with Git. And then finally, a chapter on server software administration, talking about the big server software pieces that most people are going to be interested in, Apache, MySQL/MariaDB, installing PHP, and installing and configuring email routing through a smart host so that your server can send email out. And receive email. And then the book finishes up with a couple of applied chapters, a chapter on installing WordPress, since a lot of people are interested in WordPress, most likely they've heard of it. They might have used it at a workplace. And, you know, obviously once you've installed one big open source software package, you sort of know the drill with some of the others where, you know, you set up a database and get the files to where they need to be and those things. A chapter on a weekly administration checklist, so what you need to be doing each week to keep your server up and running and keeping an eye on things, not, you know, forgetting to do software updates until 6 months later and then all of a sudden your server's been hacked 6 times and you have to turn it and just start again. Which I've seen people do where, oh, it's up and running, good, I don't have to touch it. And then a year and a half later, hey, why is my website sending spam to everyone?
Yeah.
Why is it when I go there, I get taken to a different pop-up ad or something like that? Well, that's, it's because somehow they got in. And then lastly, the final chapter of the book talks about different open source applications that I personally find really useful, really cool applications that you might not have thought that you could, quote unquote, roll your own with. So things like Moodle, which is an open source learning management mm-hmm. system. So if you've ever had to do any sort of, say your company has a training regimen that you put new employees through and you want to have a little automated course for them to move through, you might say, well, this will work well for me to do. I talk in there about URLs, YOURLS, which is basically a package that lets you turn your domain name into a bit.ly or a tiny URL like service. So if you want to be able to give people short addresses to go to long complex URLs, you can do that. I talk about one of the successors to a very common commerce platform, so OS Commerce, if you want to set up your own storefront. New Mailman, if you want to run mailing lists. Lime Survey, if you want to send out surveys. Udo, which is basically a small business CRM and ERP platform that's open source. OpenVPN, if you want.
Also an alien race in Doctor Who, by the way, but okay.
OpenVPN, just a ton of products that I've used over the years that I thought these are just really useful things to be able to pull out of your back pocket. MediaWiki, OS Ticket, just a ton of ideas is the last chapter, basically. What can you do now that you're at this point? That's why the last chapter is open source application possibilities. And yeah, that is the book. It is sort of to get you up and running if you have never run a virtual private server. And if you have, it is maybe some things you hadn't thought about. Maybe you know how to log into one, but you always had a guy that did the backups for you and you don't know exactly how to do backups. Or someone set it all up for you years ago, but you don't know how the database administration works if you wanted to create a new database on there or those sorts of things.
Or for people who signed up to just create a website and became populated with WordPress, but they didn't know there was actually a shell that could log into and those stuff themselves in the back end. In fact, I forgot how to log into my shell. I got to go look it up now. It's been so long. Mm-hmm. I just use a GUI front end to do the updates and things, so I haven't really had to go to the command line in years. In fact, I think the last time I went was with a previous provider that didn't provide updates as well. And basically, like you said, I think my PHP-based WordPress was hacked. And so I had to go in and clean up I had to go clean up source code, which was a lot of fun, versus reinstalling, because there are so many little things I was afraid were going to break if I simply reinstalled. I remember having to write some Python scripts or something to go search for certain kinds of things to let me know what I needed to fix, and it was a giant hassle. In general, what do you think about running virtual private servers these days, John? I mean, it's not for the faint of heart. I mean, it's sort of like building your own car. You really got to want to do it.
It is not for the faint of heart, but it is still one of those things that I think gives you a better understanding of what can be done on the internet versus what is more difficult. And I do know that as someone who interacts with corporate IT groups and various places I've worked and various companies that I have relationships with, there are times that knowing how a VPS works and knowing how the cloud works have allowed me to call them out on certain things that I thought that's not possible. Because yes, it is possible. It's not very hard, and if you would like, I will give you some suggestions on how you can do it. I think that empowers people a lot more, even if all you're doing with your virtual private server is something that's a hobby or something that you maybe are not ready to roll out completely. It gives you the knowledge of, hey, I can get that up and running for you. I tell the story in the book that I have a small team of people that I lead as part of a volunteer group with a professional organization I'm in. And we are the internet editors for this group, which means we get requests whenever someone has to update something in one of our internet properties, or you know, someone has a new book that needs published online, those sorts of things. And I installed a ticket system purely for a three-man group, just so that we could keep track of who was assigned to what thing and how you know, long these things are taking, how we could easily find, you know,
nice.
Something that happens every year. What did we do last year? How did we handle it? And, it, you know, a lot of people tell me, well, that's overkill. You only got three people and you get a request once every few weeks that takes more than a few minutes. Why would you do that? Well, because it's possible. You can do it. There's no reason to not do it. And there are some benefits you can gain out of doing
it. Actually, it makes sense, because if you don't do something frequently, you might forget how you did it, why you did it, where something is. It makes sense to have it automated.
Yeah,
so, I agree.
It's little things like that that I hope this book helps people. You know, it's funny. During the pandemic, I wrote two books that were collections of some of my best tips. The one was on R, the programming language, practical R4. This one's on VPSs. So now I'm kind of out of ideas. I used up 20 years of good ideas across these two books. And I do actually have, I did sign a contract this last week to work on a revision of a book.
Oh, good.
A book that was published in 2013 that the original author isn't interested in updating, but it looks like a fun project. So I'm going to jump on that as a second author and do a revision of that. So
nice.
I try to keep things busy, and you
sounds
can always
like it.
Find you go to johnwestfall.com. Right on the sidebar at the right, there's a thing that says "Visit me on Amazon." You can go to my Amazon author page. See all the stuff I've written. Technical or non-fiction or fiction.
Yeah, that's right. John writes fiction too. Yeah, I should say you.
Both parts. My weird. Yes.
I refer to you in the fourth person. I'm not sure. But so what's the name? I mean, we'll have a link for it in the show notes. But what's the name of your book? The new book again on virtual private server management.
Well, because it is about setting up and managing your virtual private server, it is literally titled "Set Up and Manage Your Virtual Private Server."
Nice. Okay, that should be pretty. We'll have a link in the show notes to APRAS for John's
and
new
I'll
book.
If any of our fives of listeners feel like they would like to write the book or a review, if you're interested in being able to kind of help others by reading through and deciding how it is. Please let me know, and I can see about getting you a review copy so that you can make your thoughts known on Amazon and other platforms what you think of the book.
Yeah, and we assume that all of our five listeners all know John, which is probably true. So you know how to reach him.
If not, johnwestfall.com/contact.
Yep. johnwestfall.com/contact. Got it. Alrighty, John. We will. We are done. That was it. We didn't have a lot to say, you know. I'm still waiting for Apple announcement and Google announcements and stuff like that. So, but we will.
And
we'll
there
talk
were rumors this week about an iPad Mini 6. So
nothing,
we'll,
right?
We'll just have to
nothing
see
so
what
far.
Happens. I'm hopeful that there will be an iPad Mini 6.
After me too.
So many years wondering if they were going to kill it off. I'll take that. There's just rumors right now of a new one.
Yeah, I was just checking. I think I bought my iPad Mini 5 2 years ago. So it is now 2 years since the last new model iPad Mini was announced. I think it was like 3 or 4 years between the Mini 4 and Mini 5. So
it has now been 755 days since the last iPad Mini release. Before that, 460 or before that, it was 922 days.
Oh, okay, so it's about 3 years roughly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I too am looking for that. I should say my iPad Mini 5 is working quite well. You know, I would kind of like one that worked with an Apple Pencil 2 versus the Apple Pencil 1. I would kind of like one with a smaller bezel, although rumors are the bezel is not going to shrink that much. And I would like one with face recognition, which, you know, and I also want a phone that has fingerprint recognition. So I want the opposite for the two devices. That's it. I think iOS 14.5 is due out soon, And one of the features for the iPhone is to allow you to unlock your iPhone with your watch, if you have an Apple Watch. So if you're wearing a face mask out there, and you know it doesn't do the facial recognition, you're supposed to, I guess, be able to like double tap your watch or something to unlock it, which I hope is true, and I hope it's out soon.
I agree.
Okay, we will talk to you next time.